This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 20, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Pogado. Members from the House Judiciary Committee look into President Bush's authorization of domestic spying. Groups in Australia protest against their government placing asylum seekers on an island detention center. And after 4 years of declared ceasefire, we'll take a look at the increasing violence in Sri Lanka. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Preliminary results are in from Iraq's parliamentary elections. The United Iraqi Alliance, dominated by Shia Muslims, won more seats than any other party, but failed to secure an absolute majority. The Shia religious bloc will likely have to form a coalition government with Kurdish and Sunni factions. Groups alleging fraud have 2 days to challenge the preliminary results. Nepal's king declared an all-day curfew and deployed more than 20,000 soldiers to the streets of the capital city today to prevent a demonstration called by opposition groups. Vinod Kejos has the story.
Army vehicles with machine guns were stationed across Kathmandu, while thousands of soldiers and police in green and blue marched almost every street, square, and junction. Anybody who broke the curfew was picked up and taken in custody. Nepal's king had imposed a curfew in advance of what was to be today's large anti-monarchy demonstration. King Gyanendra ordered the arrest of all the leaders and organizers of the rally by last night. Though the monarchy is silent, it is assumed that more than 500 pro-democracy leaders are now in custody. Today, the traffic was blocked and movement of civilians impeded by armed police and army. The majority of Nepal is under the control of Maoist guerrillas. Fearing overthrow, King Gyanendra seized absolute power a year ago. He arrested opposition leaders and imposed restrictions on the media and civil liberties. He justified his actions by saying a communist revolution is at the doorstep. This is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
The internet search engine Google is refusing to comply with a Department of Justice request that the company turn over data on millions of internet searches. In Washington, D.C., Evelyn Caldwell has the story.
On Wednesday, the Department of Justice asked a San Jose federal judge to order Google to comply with a subpoena to hand over information on millions of internet searches and web addresses. The Justice Department is seeking the information under the terms of a 1998 anti-pornography law that the Supreme Court has deemed unconstitutional. Included in the data requests are week-long lists of every Google search made and 1 million randomly selected web addresses. The government says it needs the information to determine how often porn appears in searches and whether the 1998 Child Protection Act is more effective than internet filters. Google responded yesterday, saying that the department's demand is overreaching and that the company will continue to resist the request. Google company policy protects personal information, although it says it will comply with government and legal requests. Search engines MSN and Yahoo have already given information to the department. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Evelyn Caldwell in Washington, D.C.
Civil rights advocates in Virginia are challenging a state law that restricts prison inmates' access to public records. From Richmond, Catherine Comp reports.
Joseph Giratano, a hepatitis C-positive inmate at Virginia's Red Onion State Prison, filed a lawsuit this week to challenge a 1997 Virginia statute that prohibits prisoners from requesting government documents under the state's Freedom of Information Act. Giratano wanted to know if the treatment he was receiving was adequate, but he was denied the Freedom of Information request seeking copies of the prison's protocol for hepatitis C treatment. The lawsuit states Virginia is violating the constitutional right to equal protection and the right to access the courts. Michigan, Louisiana, and Texas have similar statutes excluding prisoners from FOIA rights. Several other states, including New Jersey and Ohio, put restrictions on what information a prisoner can request. For FSRN, I'm Catherine Comp.
Nigeria's president has approved a bill prohibiting amorous relationships and marriages between people of the same sex. The government says the intention is to check the erosion of Nigeria's value system. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The bill approved this week prescribes a 5-year jail term with no option of fine for offenders. Nigeria's attorney general, whose office drafted the bill, describes same-sex marriage as un-African. The government says the bill is a reaction to the increase of homosexual behavior in developing countries. Nigeria's gay and lesbian community has grown in recent years. Gay and lesbian organizations held a rally late last year in the federal capital, Abuja, to demand equal rights. The rally embarrassed both the Nigerian government and the country's influential but conservative Anglican Church. Under the new law, it will be a criminal offense for anyone to hold such a rally. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Democratic members from the House Judiciary Committee held an unofficial hearing today on President Bush's authorization of domestic spying without a court order. The hearing comes as the Department of Justice releases its most detailed explanation of why the president could go beyond the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that requires such surveillance have a court order. Mitch Jezerich reports from Capitol Hill.
In a room not much larger than a classroom in the basement of the House Rayburn Office Building, the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers of Detroit, presided over an unofficial hearing attended only by Democratic lawmakers on President Bush's authorizing the National Security Agency to conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens without judicial approval.
What may be most troubling of all is that if we let domestic spying programs continue, if we let our president convince us that we are at war so that he can do what he wants, we will allow to stand the principle that the president alone can decide what laws apply to him.
We're here in the basement today because evidently all of the committee rooms are in use today. Which is odd because we are technically in recess, but I'm sure that's the only explanation.
That was Democratic Representative Adam Schiff of California. Today's hearing was an unofficial one because the House Republican leadership refused to call its own hearing. However, the Senate Judiciary Committee will hold an official hearing on domestic spying on February 6th when Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez will testify for the administration. In a 42-page analysis sent to Congress on Thursday, the Justice Department made its most detailed defense of spying yet. The document cited the Federalist Papers and other historical writings to justify the program so to thwart a potential terrorist attack. Yesterday, Vice President Dick Cheney also defended the program.
The activities conducted under this authorization have helped us to detect and prevent possible terrorist attacks against the American people. As such, this program is critical to the national security of the United States.
But one of today's witnesses, Bruce Fain, a constitutional scholar, told the ad hoc committee that the Bush administration's rationale for the spy program would unconstitutionally give the president unlimited powers to execute the so-called war on terror.
The president could claim on his customary incident of war he could put people in concentration camps, as was done in World War II, claiming these are people who are likely to be spies and saboteurs and aiders of Al-Qaeda. I don't need a warrant, and since Roosevelt did in World War II, I can do it now. He could authorize breaking and entering of homes in order to secure intelligence to fight the war against terrorism, as despite the fact there's an authorized procedure in an amendment to FISA that governs physical searches.
Kate Martin is the director of the Center for National Security Studies. She was also one of the witnesses at today's hearing.
Remember that until the New York Times revealed this program, he withheld the fact from the American people that his view was that FISA did not limit his powers. He secretly believed that he had broader authority than was laid out in the public statutes, but he withheld and misled the American people about that view of his own powers.
Also testifying at today's unofficial congressional hearing was Richard Hirsch with the Quaker and anti-war group The Truth Project in Florida. A few weeks ago, NBC News broke the story that Pentagon undercover agents were attending the group's meetings.
President Bush tells us only a few phone calls are listened to, but that's not true. Mr. Bush says they only monitor calls to foreign countries, but that is absolutely untrue. He tells us he spies only on known Al-Qaeda contacts or affiliates. But I know for a fact that is not true because I was spied on in a house of worship in the United States and in private homes in Florida where I was meeting with other peaceful persons engaged in constitutionally protected activity.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Cheserich in Washington.
It's been nearly 4 years since the Sri Lankan ceasefire declaration offered some hope for peace in the troubled multi-ethnic island nation. However, the threat of conflict between the Tamil Tigers, who are fighting for the rights of the minority Tamils, and the Sinhalese-dominated central government has never fully disappeared. And in the years since the Asian tsunami devastated the country's coastal areas, tensions between the two sides have dramatically increased. Next Monday, the Norwegian government, which has been facilitating Sri Lanka's peace process, will send an envoy to discuss the situation with both sides. The talks, which will take place as killings continue on a daily basis, could determine whether peace will prevail. Rachel Marr and Sam Silva filed this report, starting with Jahan Pereira, who explains the violent situation currently facing Sri Lanka.
If we go to the north and east, we will find that the people are living in a situation of utter fear and terror. Even in Colombo, there's a lot of anxiety now about the possibility of bombs exploding. Essentially, there's also a fear that the country is heading towards imminent resumption of hostilities, of open warfare.
Jehan Pereira is the executive director of the Nonpartisan National Peace Council. Tamils and Sinhalese have coexisted for centuries in Sri Lanka. But since 1956, when the president made the Sinhalese language the official language, Tamils have been excluded from public offices and institutions, rendering Sri Lanka's largest minority a marginalised people in their own country. The persistent ethnic conflict today is about the rights of the Tamil people to control territory and have a share in political and cultural decision-making. Pathmini Sithamparanathan is a member for the Tamil National Alliance, a political party aligned with the Tamil Tigers. She's the representative of the northern district of Jaffna, the Tamil heartland.
We like Sinhala people and we like to stay together, but we want our rights. We want to be equal. That's our demand.
The Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, or LTTE, have used violence in the past and gained control of land as a result. As an armed force, the LTTE has a complex relationship with Tamil civilian populations in the north and east of the island, where the Sinhalese government's occupying army represents a discriminating power.
LTTE is the only group that is looking after Tamils. You know, north and east, now the problem is army staying there. That's why this violation is taking place. If withdraw army, we can immediately start the peace talks.
But the LTTE is the target of strong criticism from within the Sinhalese majority government. Narendra Ganatilake is the secretary of the International Affairs Committee of the National Heritage Party, a small but vocal supporter of the centralised government and strongly opposed to Tamil demands for a separate territory or a federated nation.
We are totally opposed to the concept that the LTTE is the sole representative of the Tamils. We are very much alarmed and we want the international community to come in and help a friendly nation which is under threat from a terrorist movement.
In the 3 years since the ceasefire, negotiations between the two parties have broken down at every stage. This and the apparent lack of willingness by the southern administration to consider a federal solution have frustrated the LTTE. In recent weeks, the north and east districts have witnessed a significant increase in violence. Over 70 government soldiers and many Tamil civilians have been killed. On Christmas Day, a Tamil politician was gunned down in church during Mass. Jehan Pereira from the National Peace Council.
Both sides have been using violence in violation of the ceasefire agreement.
Ultimately, the Sri Lankan people want peace and coexistence on their island. But what are the options? The suggestion of a federated government where power is shared has gained some support, but both sides are reluctant to compromise or even negotiate. The Norwegian envoy has a difficult job on its hands. Jehan Pereira again.
So it's in the LTTE's interest as well as the government's to find some way to share power in the north and east. And shared rule is possible through federal arrangements. But I'm not too optimistic about a quick political solution or progress, really, because there's absolutely no trust at the moment between the government and the LTTE.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia, with Sam Silva in Colombo, Sri Lanka.
It's been 2 years since 43 West Papuans arrived in the far north of Australia after traveling by canoe for 5 days across the Torres Strait. The group of 43 men, women, and children, comprised of West Papuan independence activists and their families, have fled persecution from the Indonesian military and strung a banner across their canoe accusing Indonesia of genocide. West Papua, a former Dutch colony that was taken by Indonesia in the 1960s after a sham referendum, has seen an influx of big corporations mining resources like gold and tin, and West Papuans have been persecuted ever since. The Australian government has flown the asylum seekers to Christmas Island, its offshore detention center, despite protests from the Greens and community groups who say there is no reason to remove these people from the mainland. Cinema Napard has more from Sydney.
Liz Beock, human rights and refugee lawyer and spokesperson for the International Commission of Jurists, or ICJ, believes the Australian government hasn't treated the West Papuan asylum seekers appropriately.
I think it's absolutely outrageous that they were moved to Christmas Island. Now, these people came directly from an area of conflict in West Papua where their lives were at risk. They came to Australia to seek protection. We should have been able to keep them in mainland Australia to ensure that they were properly assisted and given proper medical care also.
Green Senator Kerry Nettles.
I think that it's part of this government's approach to try to hide the ugliness of its policy of mandatory detention and locking families up in this way.
West Papua has been fraught with problems for years due to Indonesian occupation and multinational mining companies taking resources without adequate compensation to the local people. Over to Anne Noonan from the Australia West Papua Association and the Medical Association for the Prevention of War.
There's huge money there. Rio Tinto, Freeport, BHP Gold, tin. It's a huge earner for Jakarta, but the West Papuans have the poorest health in the whole of Indonesia. They've got a huge infant mortality rate, one of the highest in the world. They're mostly dead by 60.
The International Commission of Jurists has monitored the situation in West Papua for many years, despite difficulties in getting information out because journalists and human rights groups are not allowed into West Papua. However, it is known that the Indonesian military make a lot of money through protection, often of multinational mining companies. ICJ spokesperson Liz Beock says the situation is getting worse.
With the meetings that we've had, with, say, church leaders, we've found out that there is a large amount of military violence. The numbers of Indonesian troops have been increased by 10,000 in the last year, and there's real crackdowns in the highlands, especially those areas that are resource-rich.
Indonesia has denied allegations of genocide, but concedes that there are political problems between Indonesia and West Papua. Indonesian officials met with the asylum seekers yesterday, and unfortunately, as Anne Noonan from the Australia West Papua Association reports, there has been more violence in West Papua this afternoon.
4 people have been shot by the Indonesian military in the area of Panai, which is where some of these people have come from.
Immigration Minister Senator Amanda Vanstone has refused Indonesia's request to return the asylum seekers, and she has also made assurances that the asylum seekers will be treated on the basis of their claims, not on the basis of Australia's relationship with Indonesia. John Wing from the University of Sydney's Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies says there are reports that Indonesian military activity is increasing in Papua, and this means more people may seek asylum in Australia. For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Cinema Nippard.
Haitian voters are scheduled to head to the polls on February 7 to elect a new leader, almost 2 years after the U.S., French and Canadian-sponsored coup d'etat toppled then-President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. As FSRN's Aaron Lakoff reports from Port-au-Prince, violence against the poor continues in the nation's capital.
As Haiti moves closer and closer to its presidential elections on February 7th, anger is turning against MINUSTAH, the United Nations Stabilization Mission. On January 16th, Haiti's elite group of 184, led by spokesperson Andy Aped, held a demonstration in front of the UN headquarters in Port-au-Prince to express their dissatisfaction with MINUSTAH in preventing the recent wave of kidnappings and crime. However, Others charge that the Group of 184 is using the UN to mount a campaign of political cleansing prior to the elections. Haitian activist and former member of Jean-Bertrand Aristide's government, Patrick Ely, explains.
I think all the moves you've seen, all the strident speeches by the likes of Apaid and Boulos reflect their own panic in front of their total lack of success in whatever project they had for this country. They've had 2 years, and we see the results.
Apaid is the owner of Alpha Industries, an overseas sweatshop that fabricate clothing for the Canadian company Gildan Activewear. Aristide doubled the minimum wage to $4 US per day during his tenure as president, much to the distaste of the garment industry. The same day that the Group of 184 held these demonstrations, 4 people were killed by UN forces in Cité Soleil, one of the capital's poorest areas and the largest base of support for Lavalas presidential candidate René Préval. Paul Lulu-Chéri, the General Secretary of the Confederation of Haitian Workers, offers his analysis of the Group of 184's pressure tactics.
Ce sont eux qui avaient fait appel à la ministre. Aujourd'hui, ils critiquent la ministre. Vous questionnez pourquoi?
They were the ones who called in MINUSTAH, and today they're criticizing MINUSTAH. We have to ask why. Perhaps MINUSTAH isn't responding exactly to their plan, which is to destroy the Haitian people. They say that the kidnappers are only in Cité Soleil, but that's not what we think. So due to the fact that MINUSTAH is not destroying the whole population, today they have a lot of problems with MINUSTAH.
At 11 p.m. on January 18th, the St. Catherine's Hospital in Cité Soleil came under heavy fire from the UN. Lenny Bien-Aimé, an eyewitness to the shooting, explains.
It is thanks to the hospital that my child isn't already dead. For me to see her while we were lying down in the hospital, and then MINUSTAH came and fired at the children in the hospital. 3 nurses almost died, all in one incident. If, as you see, MINUSTAH keeps on killing people, killing people, killing people, they just keep shooting. If the nurses get shot, there won't be any nurses. There won't be any doctors to come into Cité Soleil to give us care anymore.
3 more Cité Soleil residents were killed by gunfire on Thursday morning. So far, the body count has risen to over 10 in Cité Soleil this week alone, as well as 2 Jordanian UN troops who were killed on Monday. Despite the violence, Préval is still the candidate favored to win in the election on February 7th. This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Because of errors at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Portland lawyer Brandon Mayfield was arrested in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings that killed 191 people. A recently released report from the Office of the Inspector General details the FBI's mistakes. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has more from Portland, Oregon.
FBI fingerprint analysts relied on minute details in a print lifted from a bag of detonators to link Muslim American Brandon Mayfield to the Madrid train bombings, according to the Inspector General's report.
We're talking about human examiners, and as long as the human element is part of the equation, then there's always a potential for a mistake. And regrettably, that's what occurred in this case.
That's Paul Bresson, a public affairs specialist with the FBI in Washington, D.C. He says the human errors made in this case had to do with the unusual similarity between the fingerprints and not with bias related to Mayfield's Muslim faith.
There was no misconduct on the part of the FBI. And religion played no improper role, and there was no abuse or misuse of the Patriot Act.
The report makes it clear that FBI examiners were not aware of Mayfield's religion when they concluded he was the source of the fingerprint in question. Nor did they have knowledge of his wife, who is an Egyptian immigrant, or the fact that Mayfield had represented a convicted terrorist, one of the Portland 7, in a child custody case. However, one examiner admitted that if the person identified had been someone without these characteristics, like the Maytag repairman, the lab might have re-examined their original conclusion with more skepticism and caught the error. Mayfield spent 2 weeks in custody and at least a month under covert surveillance before Spanish National Police correctly linked the print lifted from the bag of detonators to an Algerian national.
This case is a classic example of the manner in which the breach of the wall between intelligence and law enforcement that the Patriot Act allowed has harmed an innocent man.
Stephen Wax is a lawyer with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Portland, Oregon. He represented Mayfield after his arrest in May of 2004.
The National Security Administration, the CIA, the Department of Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI Intelligence Unit, et cetera, has received information, which has then been transmitted from its headquarters to its various field offices. Hundreds, thousands of people around the world have had access to it. It's been copied, recopied, and recopied, and it will be virtually impossible to make Mr. Mayfield whole in the sense of getting him back his privacy.
Mayfield has filed a civil suit against the FBI, the Department of Justice, and several individuals for the alleged violation of his civil liberties, as well as violations to the U.S. Constitution. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
And as we close our newscast today, we also say goodbye to Mitch Jezerich as Washington editor. Mitch has worked with our editorial team for over 2 years. On behalf of the entire team here at FSRN, we would like to thank you for all your hard work and wish you the very best in the future. Let's hear back from some of Mitch Jezerich from Washington, D.C.
A bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation has been in Iraq and is calling on the U.S. to send more troops and money before it is, quote, too late. Al also showed satellite photos as evidence that Iraq moved weapons from bunker to bunker. Powell said Iraq had anthrax and 4 tons of the nerve agent VX, and that biological weapons factories were put on trucks. While human rights groups applaud the potential release of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, they also fear those released will be from the countries that are considered to be allies to the U.S. Reporters waited for hours outside the Republican House caucus meeting that was slated to be a short one to hear whether the Republicans would accept a rule change to allow House Republican leader Tom DeLay to maintain the leadership even if he were to be indicted for campaign finance violations in Texas. They did. As lawmakers inside the Capitol begin debating the $2.6 trillion budget resolution for 2006, which sets the parameters for a final budget, about 250 demonstrators gathered outside to protest against the proposal that attempts to make President Bush's tax cuts permanent while significantly cutting... A 2002 internal British government document recently leaked to the British press indicates that just months before the Iraqi invasion, that British official said that the case for war was, quote, thin. According to the memo, British officials indicated that the Bush administration was trying to create justifications to go to war. The measure makes permanent about 9 provisions that deal with intelligence matters, including Section 215 that gives FBI access to business and library records, Section 201 that allows roving wiretaps, and Section 213 that allows for delayed notice search warrants. At 11 p.m., the House went to vote on the controversial free trade agreement. And an hour later, supporters had their votes.
The yeas are 217, the nays are 215.
On this issue.
About 100 demonstrators picketed outside the White House in protest of President Bush's handling of the rescue effort and aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. They held signs. President Bush's National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, would not deny that the CIA is operating secret jails throughout the world. Former counsel to President Richard Nixon, John Dean, said that President Bush's acknowledgement of authorizing the NSA to conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens makes him the first president to admit to an impeachable offense. The
for Free Speech Radio News, Democrat. I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
FSRN is proud to announce that we have chosen Leanne Caldwell as our new Washington editor.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.